That's all we cook with, Ryan. Fire.
What else is there to cook with, folks? Welcome to another episode of To the Unknown Pod, episode 22. Can you believe it? Our first episode beyond the mythical, magical 21 that Bitcoiners are obsessed with. We are glad to have you here. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere.
I'm Oshawa Hawthorne, director of Brilliance Labs, a Christian social innovation lab. We help start things. We like working with Bitcoin.
I'm Ryan Finley, entrepreneur, dad of six. Big Bitcoin fan. And I'm representing Tin Shack Bakery. We miss you, Matt. Matt won't be joining us today.
Matt's got cooler things to do. So for those of you who this is your first time, we just want to let you know, what in the world are you getting yourself into? Well, every week we spend time on Twitter and we basically want to redeem that time. We want to use it and take the highlights, the cream that rises to the top. We want to take those things and bring them here and chat about them with people who love the Lord, who are experts in their field, and we just want to kind of chew over them and just talk about them and about things that we think would benefit you guys at home, depending on what your situation is. So we're going to get off and running this week.
Are we supposed to be experts in our field? If you're looking for experts, this is probably not the show.
Are you fishing for compliments? Because Oshawa is literally the leader of Bitcoin missions world. So, you are an expert.
No, you're getting people's expectations.
Ryan is an expert in raising functional children who are actually productive. Let's see, what else? We can... Matt's an expert at avoiding being on podcasts. Let's see what else. So anyhow, this week, this episode, we're going to be focusing on basically a problem that I'm sure many of you have either heard about or are experiencing, depending on where you find yourself in the generational ladder here. But basically this issue of Gen Z and home ownership, and or just, you know, even younger millennials in home ownership, we're basically at a point where it's very difficult. There's lots of people who do not own homes and don't have what appears to be a path to home ownership in the foreseeable future. And so Ash, why don't you kind of just outline some of the reasons why we find ourselves in that problem, in that situation, and then we can kind of talk about what we think Bitcoin has to do with the solution. But maybe just kind of outline that and do your best steel manning that as an actual problem.
Wow. Well, you have a few different issues. So real estate has been used as kind of the middle class path to wealth. And it's easy to leverage. It's easy to capitalize upon. So you can do your home equity line of credit. You could cash out, refinance, and start a business. You can refinance and get another house and kind of build from there. House prices have gone up over time. But there's something called a monetary premium. And it's just this idea that the house has a utility. It provides you important value that you need to raise a family. But also, it is an investable asset. And so you have folks, and this happened during the COVID period, where you have these unrealistically low interest rates and then a whole ton of money printing. And you had groups like BlackRock buying up a bunch of single family homes. And so you had all these buyers, you had all this relocation. So people working remotely during COVID, and then all of a sudden they can live anywhere they want because they're allowed to work from their computer. And so you had people fleeing the cities and going to high desirability kind of places. And that just led to a huge increase of real estate prices. And then you have kind of the bottom following out where the interest rates have gone up to combat inflation, but the real estate prices are sticky, right? They're not just going to crash naturally apart from some big disruptor in the market. And so you've had elevated prices in houses from the COVID rush, but now you've raised the interest rate. So you have affordability, interest rate plus the price. So your monthly payment is the worst that it's literally ever been. And so the older generation saying, hey, suck it up, young ones. Like we had 12% interest rate in the 70s. I'm like, yeah, you could buy a house for the price of a 20-year-old Toyota Corolla. Like, so it's not apples to apples. It's entirely different to have these historically average rates with historically absolutely like irrationally high prices. So there you go.
There's a good summary of the issue. Let's further complicate this and further kind of, you know, explain why this is, you know, gotten so bad. One of the other exacerbating features that you have is the fact that we now have so much debt. Like if you're a young person and you're graduating high school and you're going into college, the vast majority of them are going to be taking out loans for college, because college, due to also getting the same sort of influx of capital due to, you know, governments throwing grants at, students, and basically giving them free money. It's done is just increase the price of college. And so in order to then adapt and pay for that elevated price of college, people take out loans, which, as we've mentioned in the past, are incredibly the only type of debt that you can't declare bankruptcy on. Are student loans, which is just horribly insane and unjust if you think about it for longer than 30 seconds. So that's another thing, is it's not just that we have record home prices, it's also that you have record home prices and record runaway student debt. You also have runaway debasement of the degrees that you're actually getting with your college education. The education has never been worse in terms of the actual end product. You can find high school exams from 100 years ago would be like PhD exams today when you compare them to the quality of education. And so, obviously this is not absolute. At the highest ranges of education, the highest, you know, echelon, you're going to still find super rigorous education. But in many places, you know, what you're paying for does not in any way correspond with what you're actually getting, especially outside of fields like engineering and, medical, whether you're a doctor, nurse, whatever it is. If you're in those, you can still make, you know, decent money. There still are other consequences. That can put pressure on you. But for the average person who's just getting
10 years of school and
you're going
$100,000 of debt.
Correct. So you're still in a different gold place, but there still are mechanisms for you to make that valuable. You'll have hospitals that will hospitals that will pay off your debt. Basically, they'll say, hey, work for us for this amount of years and we'll pay off your debt. And you're like, okay, great. So there's not those same kind of debt relief mechanisms that exist in many other fields. And so a bunch of these factors put together. Anybody else want to add any other factors that are contributing to this?
Yeah, the zero interest rate policy that was going on. So you had, during COVID, you had people that were still getting 2.75, maybe 3.5% mortgages, or they were refinancing their mortgages at a time when inflation was like 8 or 9%. Mm. So it was literally, the simplest decision in the entire world for millions and millions of homeowners to refinance their house during that time. And now it effectively froze millions of people in place. Because if you sell your house, you lose your low interest rate mortgage and your housing payment will double if you want to move across the street. So people aren't moving. And the effect that has is it prevents a housing correction from picking up steam. Like, we're starting to go through a housing correction right now, but if you had the normal number of people just moving, those houses would have to sell. And when they went on the market, it would just add more supply. And supply is still picking up right now. So it's starting, that actually was incredibly effective of the Fed. They're a little sneaky, in a sense that they froze everyone in place basically, and or they rugged them in a sense. So right now the houses that are going on the market, a lot of them are like the baby boomers that are moving into retirement homes, and they're price insensitive, so they just you know, they're going into a high monthly payment assisted living center, and they just sell their house at whatever the market will pay.
Yeah.
And that's picking up.
Yeah. And so there's some other issues. So again, so Oshawa talked about the monetary premium. There's this, you know, added value that has nothing to do with the value of the house itself, that is added to the price of a house. So that makes it, you know, raises the value, which again, if you're a homeowner, you might think, oh, that's good news for me. My house goes up in value. But the problem is that even for you, like a lot of these, you know, a lot of this, these houses as investments in this monetary premium, you're banking on being able to sell your home for more than you paid for it. This is part of the understood agreement. The problem with that is, again, interest rates freeze that. But another problem is, okay, so if even if interest rates are high, you get to the point where you're depending on selling this house or downsizing or whatever, you know, and you have to sell. Let's say you live in the north, you're getting ready to retire. Prices aren't where you wish they were, but you're kind of forced into doing it. And you're going to, you know, so you sell your house. Well, you know, if normal economic actors, like normal people, if prices are so elevated relative to the amount of earnings that they're getting, that they're not able to buy, you would assume, well, this would drive some price corrections. But unfortunately, there are plenty of other actors who aren't anywhere near as affected by real economic calculation as normal people are. And those would namely be, you know, larger corporations, larger companies, international interests. So as bad as things appear and have been recently in the United States, it's 100 times worse for many other countries around the world. And so many other people who don't have ready access to the dollar, you know, who either they have horrible national currencies in the country where they're at, and maybe they don't have ready access to the dollar, they are still buying up real estate in the United States as well, because it's a way better option than they have in their own countries. They're banking on the fact that the American economy is strong, Americans are wealthy, Americans can continue to prop up this, you know, this game of musical chairs longer and longer. And so that has just added more pressure. I was just reading an article about this yesterday, which is why it comes to mind. But this is adding more pressure onto an already, stressed real estate situation. And so things are to the point, though, in terms of the correction that we talked about. There's a chart and an article that was written yesterday that basically said there's a podcast called... it's going to kill me. It's on The Ringer. It's this guy, Derek Thompson. I can't think of what it's called, but really interesting podcast. This guy basically said, hey, so right now home prices are increasing in the Midwest and in the Northeast of the United States. They're going down, broadly speaking, in the South. And if you're in Florida, the bottom is absolutely falling out of the real estate market. And so again, there's a whole host of reasons for that. Even there's reasons, for instance, one of the things is, that the cost of insurance, home insurance, and, you know, other forms of insurance, because of a recent spate of hurricanes on top of inflation, it's just getting really, really expensive. You can no longer fix homes. And, you know, if there's some sort of problem, you can no longer fix them for the prices that these insurance contracts were denominated in. And so you're just getting to the point where, and plus these houses are getting older, and there's a whole bunch of factors that are resulting in people, not a lot of people wanting to move to Florida, or at least buy the available homes for the prices that they're at. And so there's a whole host of reasons, but this is a real problem. And unless you guys want to add anything else in terms of the problem, the question is, you know, if you're a younger millennial, if you're is there somebody between the Zoomers and the young millennials? No. Okay.
If you're a young person.
Sorry, Generation X, Gen X.
Gen X are older than millennials.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
the point is, if you're a young person and you're sitting here, you're looking around and you're like, what in the world am I supposed to do? Am I ever going to be able to own a home? You know, what we want to do with this episode is, rather than occasional, we've been, you know, maybe some like a little bit doomerish in some of these episodes
going on here.
We don't want you to black pill. We don't think there's warrant for that. But what we want to do is just like, hey, what kind of path is there towards homeownership? What kind of path is there to actually being in a position, putting yourself in a position, insofar as it depends on you, to be able to actually own a home and you know, do something about this? And so that's kind of what this episode is going to be aimed at. So I'll let one of you two kind of start this, you know, wherever you want to start in kind of unpacking where you would begin. Maybe kind of give a brief overview of your situations individually and then kind of how you've thought about these things.
You want to go first, Ryan?
Sure. Jordan, you want to pull up that Nick Gurley or Garley?
You know what, Ryan? Actually, I do. Let me pull it up first. I do want to pull it up. All right, here we go. Nick. Boom. There we go. Can you see that?
Awesome. Yep. Yeah. So I'll just go through it. Home prices in the U.S. are 16.5% overvalued in 2025. This is the higher level of overvaluation than we saw at the heights of the 2006 bubble. After that last bubble, prices became undervalued, and the period from 2008 to 2019 was a great time to buy a house. However, today's market has become too expensive with home prices outpacing wage growth. The result is an overvalued and unaffordable market. This is the main reason why home buyer demand is so low in 2025. Fix the overvaluation, fix the home buyer demand problem. So, I think it's really wise to... whenever you're analyzing a current problem, remember that it's nothing. We're not experiencing these things for the first time. Like, this has happened before. As the chart shows, you know, we had a housing crash in 2008, and houses were unaffordable and overvalued back then. I remember because my wife and I were trying to get into our first house back then leading up to it. And I just remember like, man, dude, like this is insane. I don't understand how my peers were able to get into houses at this point, because they were just, compared to like wages back then, it was very, I mean, it's worse now, but even back then it was just like, dude, how? And we, you know, come to find out that there was lots of shenanigans going on. Like, you could just lie on your mortgage application. As long as you had a pulse, you could get insane financing. They were just trying to pump that bubble to the outer space. Things are different. Like, and that's what, when you talk to people now, like, oh, it's not the same, you know, they're way more strict and they are, but houses are still very overvalued today. I think the second part of that tweet,
yeah, sharing right now, the Nick Gurley.
Yeah. 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 Let's go back to it. I just want to point out something else. If you scroll down, yeah, there it is. So, if you go down to number two, the median household in the U.S. earns around $83,000. The annual mortgage payments to buy a house, $33,000, with the resulting payment to income ratio closer to 40%. That's simply too expensive. I think where does he talk about it?
The second chart here.
Yeah, I think it's another one of the things. Anyways, another interesting point that Nick makes is that they're like, well, like if Trump just forces out Powell and we get interest rates to plummet, he basically points out that even if you drop interest rates an entire percentage point or 100 basis points, you only save about $200 on the monthly payment. And so for perspective, somebody who is trying to buy a house in like 2020 versus today, their mortgage payment is basically, it would be double what it would have been in 2020. So shaving off, you know, $200 off that, that's not going to move the needle at all. So anyone getting their hopes up that like these huge crash in interest rates are going to actually bring a whole bunch of buyers back to the market, it's not happening. I mean, I'll just tell you straight up, that's people aren't just a couple hundred dollars on their mortgage payment away from buying houses. So it's going to probably end up being both. Interest rates, I mean, the biggest thing, the easiest thing to give is going to be house prices. Everyone's like, oh, they can just pull levers and drop interest rates way back down. Like, there's huge consequences. There's a reason why they jacked them up fastest rate in history. Inflation was literally raging out of control and it's still super high. What are we at? Like 3 point, We had 3.6 now, 3.6.
It's such
or a... Or whatever the stated is. Yeah, yeah.
It's the only way I heard that, but yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Stated.
Yeah. Ground beef keeps going up 10% a year.
Yeah.
So just keep your eye on ground beef. Yeah. So all that to say, if you pull up my last... I have one last one that I shared. It's the bar chart one down there.
Let's see.
I'm going to skip straight to this one because I just think it's the
most powerful. It's on that same thread?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I can...
Bar chart. This one?
Yeah, that's the black one.
Okay, let's see here.
And as Jordan grabs that, so Darth Powell posted a Fox News segment, like a business segment, where they were claiming a 30% overpricing on real estate. So that's...
You're talking this one, Ryan?
Mm-mm. I'll post it in the studio chat.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Is it this one?
Yeah. So 30, you keep going, Rosh. 30% overpriced. They're saying real estate's 30% overpriced.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's not good.
So we can do this one. Is this what you're looking at?
I got it.
Yeah.
This one?
Oh, wait, no.
This is him. Oh, so I'll do this and then you, Jordan, show the other one. Basically, Darth Powell's saying only 27% of households can afford a median home.
Mm.
Right? And then 80% of households earning $140,000 already own. So you have 50% of the housing market is chasing 5.4% of the home buyers that can afford a home that they don't already own.
Oof.
Yeah.
All right, let's pull this one up, Ryan. It's this one, right? Bar chart.
There. Yeah. So I think I encourage people not to overfixate on what popped the bubble. Back in 08, it was insane. Like, they were just letting anybody, a whole bunch of shenanigans with the quality of loans being given out. Anyways, at the end of the day, they over-financialized the housing market to unsustainable levels. And once it pops, it pops. It's going to go back down. You see, and it returned back to somewhat sanity. And even then, it would have gone a lot lower, but the government stepped in. And there was millions of foreclosed on houses back then.
Yeah,
that they refused to let go out on the market, and they trickled them out like a little stream. So this would have gone way lower, and it should have, because it would have been healthy. We needed to return back to health, but they pumped it back. They pumped the bubble back up as fast as they could. So you can see it just this huge crash back towards it being affordable. And I was like, I think both Osh and I bought houses at that time. And then now we're back up to 2025. Well, here's the thing. Like, you can guess what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Whenever housing is extremely unaffordable, it will always return back one way or another. And it's just gravity. Unless human nature changes, because at the end of the day, you can't, if you make it impossible for all young people in a nation to get into housing, like, pitchforks will come out and civil unrest follows. So, like, yeah, you can
and we're already getting a fair amount of, like, you know, pitting of the, like, for, in order to gain political power, pitting of the generations against each other. It's just a really dangerous and unfortunate thing that's happening. The other thing that I would want to mention here too is this like dynamic of like whipsawing. I mean, this obviously, let's see, you know, this is 2006, 2025. So you're talking 19 years. Again, for some of us, 2008 seems like yesterday. Like, it's insane that it's been 19 years. But like, one of the things, this is not the first time this has happened either. Like, if you look at other situations that, again, aren't necessarily, you know, that we're not in Weimar Germany. Like, I'm not stating that we're there, but like, one of the things that you see during that time is that the price of gold and the value of the local currency, it whipsawed back and forth like this. And so, like, this is evidence that, like, this is an unhealthy situation. And so, you know, you know, there likely will be, you know, a buying opportunity that, you know, prices will be significantly lower than they are right now for homes. But even then, I mean, like, even if you just look at this chart, if you just try to follow, like, where's the trend line, you know, like it's still is such a tough thing. So there's a lot of people who are out there, and, you know, in our lifetimes, if you're 40 and younger, owning a home has just been like an obvious thing. Like, well, of course you're going to buy your house. And yet I think for a lot of people, and, you know, Ryan and I can speak to this, you know, like, we're both of us are renting, you know, Ryan, you're choosing to, and then in my case, like, I'm just not in a position where it, you know, it makes sense to, you know, put as much money into, a house as would be required because of what it would cost me, in Bitcoin. So maybe, anyway, is there other charts that you guys want to lay out here and share just to kind of continue to elucidate the problem, or do we want to start talking about,
well, so before we get into the solution, let's just chat a little bit about the social consequences of this and the moral consequences. So you guys kind of hinted at this. There was this video with Peter Thiel, I think it was him, that made the rounds a few weeks ago, where he's essentially predicting the younger generation all going socialist and Marxist. And the point he makes is, he says, when they get priced out of the ownership of any assets and a participation in the economy, they're necessarily going to disbelieve in the free market. And so capitalists become socialists when they have no chance of ownership. And so that's what this kind of upstream of the housing issues, right, is the broken currency and the fiat money printing. But then downstream of not being able to purchase a home is saying, well, let the whole thing burn anyway. Then let me entirely opt out. Why should I contribute to this system if the system is broken and isn't never going to work for me? And so you had during COVID the whole kind of like Wall Street bets movement, and I would say some of the adoption of Bitcoin and the kind of the retail involvement during COVID was some of that, like, let's opt into another system.
Sure.
And I think some of the wokeness and all the like protests on campus and the BLM, that was all saying the system is not working for me for various reasons, right? They're identifying they're feeling the effect of the problem, but they're like shooting at other issues.
Attributing blame,
right?
To
blame the police for why my, like, I'm poor and everything's broken. No, it's not, like, it's upstream, go higher. There's deeper issues in our society that are moral and systemic financial, right? And so downstream of this, we're getting all the dirty water. We're dealing with these issues, and now people are going to opt out of the current system. And I think the question for us, if you're a Christian, well, historically, for millennia, Christians have built parallel systems and parallel ways of living that go against the stream, that find ways to build communities where we can help one another prosper, even while Rome burns, right? And as it says in Jeremiah 29, I mean, seek the welfare of the city. So it's not a let's care for one another at the city's expense, at the world's expense, but it's realizing that the best way to be salt and light in a failing society and a failed state is to have a healthy marriage, to love and raise your kids, to provide for your family, to love your neighbors, right? To serve in your church. And if you start in the areas that you have most responsibility and stewardship, and you're faithful there, God will bless you. He will make you fruitful. And by God's grace, we may be in, Ecclesiastes talks about this. I don't remember what chapter, about the godly man who saves the city. Or another parallel story is Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah. And the whole point is, God's, like, if there's one righteous man, right, he still has a purpose for that city. And so we get to be salt and light in Sodom and Gomorrah. And so there is hope. And the issue of real estate is like, okay, you got to go upstream You got to see the problems. You got to opt out of the current system, the financial system, the moral system, the educational system, and then rebuild in community with like-minded people. And you know what? We will both have a Noah's Ark. We will be able to survive. I mean, one of the posts that I saw this week that I really appreciated was the dude. He's a believer, the Bitcoin well guy, and
Adam O'Brien.
Yeah, yeah. So Adam used the Noah's Ark analogy for both the gospel and for Bitcoin, and I think that's fair. And I'll just share that really quick, and then I'll end my little rant. And he just says, Noah built a boat and everyone mocked him. He didn't care. He knew something that nobody else believed. God blessed him with knowledge. He wasn't building for praise. He was building to be obedient to God and protect his family. The world laughed at him until it rained. You are incredibly blessed with the foresight of what is going to happen to the current system. You know the action you need to take. Get on the boat, stack sats for your last name. Stack sats for your last name.
Goosebumps. Goodness gracious.
And so Adam is taking this, I mean, this biblical story, and this is a reality. Like, if you gain Bitcoin and lose your soul, if you gain Bitcoin and stack sats but lose your children, okay, it's all worthless. But if you can live faithfully, be faithful in your marriage, be faithful in raising your kids well, and your kids have a last name they're proud of, you get that figured out. Bitcoin is that financial piece that you now give them a way to build a future.
Yeah, it's a pretty strong analogy. I mean, just being in this space since 17, 18, you know, like pretty much nonstop, especially in those early years, it was just totally just being made fun of for being a Bitcoiner. And it's not just being made, like, it's not just that being a Bitcoiner, you were made fun of back then. Like, the problem, like the reasons we were Bitcoiners, the, like, understanding the problem, like, it was just, it was completely dismissed. Mm. Like, oh, like currency debasement, or, you know, debasement, not a big issue. Broken fiat system, you know, and all the downstream effects from that on literally everything in our culture, just completely dismissed. And
Yeah, I was, this is an interesting, I wasn't planning on talking about this, but there's, it brings to mind, there's a comedian, his name is Dan Soder. He's a comedian. I can't remember where he's based out originally, but I think I want to say Colorado or something like that, but he is like best friends with this guy, Mike McDaniel, who's the coach of the Miami Dolphins. And so they grew up together, and they were talking about this on a podcast where Dan, his parents were divorced. He never knew his dad. And like his, so he just didn't have a good home life. He had like a stepdad he wasn't a big fan of. And so he would go over to his friend Mike's house on the weekends, and he would spend there like from Friday after school until Sunday afternoon after all the NFL playoff games or NFL games were over with. And then his mom would come pick him up. And so this family became like a refuge to him. And so by virtue of him having this family be a refuge to him, who was far healthier than his home situation was, he was able to reap the benefits that he wouldn't have had if he didn't have this little, you know, this bastion of health. And so there's a real situation, I mean, there's a real analog to that in terms of like, if you're sitting here, you know, in, you know, Zoomers and you're finding yourself or younger millennials and you're sitting here, you're like, I am in an unhealthy situation. Like, you need to hitch your wagon to, like, you need to get access to some healthier situation. And so whether that's, finding mentors, whether that's finding older people who do have businesses, who do have resources, and asking them, you know, like just going on and becoming friends with them and just hearing their situation and maybe asking them like, hey, are there things that I can do to add value to you? Because I'm in a situation where, you know, I need help. Like there are people. Like one of the biggest opportunities that somebody shout to the friend Bobby Shell, he talks about all the time. He basically is like, he's building his entire life around, in terms of money making part of his life, around Bitcoin and small businesses. Because he's just saying, hey, there are so many baby boomers who are on the verge of retiring. And many of them are retiring from businesses that they don't have kids who are going to be taking them. And so they're going to be all of these businesses that you can pick up for, I mean, relatively cheap, that then you can turn around and make money with them. They're profitable businesses. And so just, you know, looking at this problem that you have and going out and talking about the problem, you know, just being able, rather than just facing the temptation and giving into the temptation, just give up and feel hopeless, yeah, or just complain and, you know, do radically dumb things, you know, just basically looking for people who are in a better situation and putting yourself next to them. And trying to listen to them and you know, have conversations with them, and again, just there, a lot of these people have expertise that they're willing to share and that they want to share. One of my favorite things, my granddad went to be with the Lord, probably four, five, six years ago, something like that. And one of the things that was just incredible, my granddad, is that he just wanted to talk to me. And he wanted to tell me stories about his life. And when I find older people, I just ask them questions. And it is incredible how frequently they just start talking. They'll just start talking. And I'll just ask them, I'll prime them with a couple questions and they'll just go. And they'll talk about, oh, I had this experience. I worked in this field and I have this going on. Like there's so many people who, again, what they don't have, they have material stuff, they've got resources, but they don't have younger people who are necessarily interested in hearing kind of their stories. And so I think that there's just a lot of opportunities for something that's, you know, if you are a scarce type person who's interested in other people and willing to dedicate time to, you know, trying to actually provide something that they're lacking, I think there actually are tons more opportunities than the average person is just thinking about.
So, Jordan, I don't know if you saw this in the public chat, but you were basically perfectly answering this question. Chat, okay. A young man asked, what's your best advice for a 21-year-old young man who is discouraged? I think you have just been answering that question. I wonder, Ryan, if you'd add anything else to Jordan's advice.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's huge. If we're going to continue to go with solutions, yeah, don't give up. Reach out to the older generation. They're a massive wealth of knowledge. Learn about Bitcoin and save even small amounts outside the system. So like the whole fiat system is like a giant carnival. Don't get tempted into playing the fiat carnival games. I would say a huge amount of the young people in our country are just being tempted into like different gambling, meme coins, sports gambling, penny stocks, just like messing around with leverage. The same, like even saving small amounts and $5 a day, $10 a day, $20 a day, like it doesn't seem like anything. It's like, it's never going to place a dent, but like that's never the truth. Even back when I remember when I was coming out of high school, I hardly had anything. I was making hardly anything, and investing in companies back then, I was like, what's the point? Like, what's the point in $50 or $100? It's like, that's literally nothing, right? Well, like just for perspective, just to hammer home the point, I want you to know that like the companies that I would have invested in, and I was a little bit, were Apple and Amazon and companies like that. And like
Ryan was billing Tesla on Facebook for years. And it performed pretty well.
I was buying Apple stock when Steve Jobs came back to Apple. But here's the thing. But even then, it was inexperienced, immature, undisciplined Ryan. And if I could do it over again and listen to my own advice, it's like, you know, it's don't underestimate the small beginnings. Like, even buying small amounts and just continuing to faithfully work hard and save. Today, I would just say be simple, buy Bitcoin, and work hard. Back then, Bitcoin didn't exist, and so you literally had to play a little bit more of the game. Which it's like it feels like a whole nother world.
Yeah.
And just know that the same, like, oh, what's it going to do? What's $50 going to do? I mean, my thesis, and I think Osh and Jordan probably agree to somewhat, like, if you can save $1,000, like, in the next, you know, I think we're at 10x in five years, potentially, maybe 100x within 10 years. So depending on how old you are, just know that, like, it could be worth 10, whatever you're able to squirrel away in Bitcoin right now, it could be worth 10 times as much in 5 years.
Yeah.
So don't get discouraged.
I mean, the first thing I would say before I give advice to Salome, I think is how you pronounce it. But like the first thing I'd say is like, you're not alone, you know, just like you're not alone. Like there's lots of people who are, you know, in similar situations, and who are, you know, who are just, you know, just frustrated the way that you are. There's also a lot of people who are in worse situations, you know, than we are. I'm somebody who I'd never owned a home. Like I've never been able to own a home. Like we were missionaries in Uruguay, like right at the prime years where if we had like a normal job, we could have been, you know, socking away money and, you know, and doing stuff like that. And we just didn't have the, you know, the resources to make that happen. And so like, I look at around it, you know, some people who are my same age and like, they've all got, you know, 7 years on me in terms of, you know, financially, in terms of like homes and, you know, all these different things. And, you know, there are moments where I catch myself where I'm like, oh man, I'm jealous or, you know, whatever it is. And I mean, just the reality is just like, hey, you know what? Like it's just one of these situations where, yeah, I don't have that situation. I'm not in their situation, but the Lord knows. And so again, I don't know if Salome's is a believer or not, but I do think that's one of these things where, you know, like pour your heart out to the Lord. And just basically just, you know, bring your things to him. He cares for you. The scriptures tell us that, you know, cast your cares on the Lord because he cares for you. You know, we don't have to sit here and try to care about our problems all by ourselves. Like God actually is there and he does care about your problems and he loves to provide for his kids. Even if you're somebody who you're like my dad, you know, this is not my story, but like if you're somebody who had a dad who wasn't there for you, you know, God loves to be a father to the fatherless. This is one of the things that he loves to do. And so the other thing that I would say is don't underestimate, like leverage the resources that you have. So if you're 21 years old and you're single, the resource that you have that other people don't have is you have your flexibility. You have flexibility and you have time. And so I had this young guy, or one of our pastors just basically encouraged the younger men in the church to reach out to older men in the church and just basically try to get advice about, you know, just start hear from where they're coming from, kind of exactly what I was describing before. And so this guy, I think he's 21 or 23 years old, just came and just basically asked if we could get breakfast. And so we did. And he just started asking me questions. And I just started asking him kind of where he was at. Like, I didn't want to just start talking, giving him advice without knowing his situation. And so he just proceeded to tell me that he's a young guy. He's living at home, but he's paying rent. So he's got to pay for a car and he's got to pay for rent. And then obviously food and stuff like that. So what he's doing is he's working two jobs. He's working one 40 hours a week, working at a restaurant. It's not glamorous. He's trying to, you know, move up and move up into management and which will result in a raise. And then on top of that, when he gets off work from that job, he goes over and works another job at a bar that's right next door. And so he is basically looking at the situation. He's basically saying, hey, what I have right now is free time. And so I'm going to maximize my free time. I'm going to do the really hard thing that's not fun right now so that I'm in a better situation so that I can basically earn money and then I can invest it. And so he's already, I mean, he's saving a good, I think at least, I mean, he's saving a good chunk of the money that he's earning. And so he's, you know, investing in the stock market and he's doing well there. And then he's also in bought Bitcoin and is doing great relative to when he got in and how much he's been buying. So I would, you know, just say, you know, coming up with a plan and then just having people go, like going to find people who can just be an encouragement to you to just stick to the plan. Cause that's one of the things, whether you're starting a business or whether you're, you know, just starting your life, it is just so easy to get discouraged when you don't have, you know, people who are, you know, you're talking to every day, people who are reminding you of what's real and what's true and, you know, what's good, and people talking about horrible failures that they've had, that set them back financially, set them back in all kinds of ways. Like everyone has these stories. It's real easy just to look at even these baby boomers and look at them like, oh, they've got so much money. They had the easiest time in the history of mankind. All they had to do is basically be monkeys and throw money at the stock market, S&P 500, and they're just millionaires. It's like there is some truth to that. And yet in many other cases, they weren't disciplined enough and they had problems that kept them from doing stuff like that. So, you know, even within a lot of the good situations that people have, they've had horrible setbacks as well. And so I just would encourage, you know, people on that front.
Yeah. I want to piggyback back on that. And also the advice to the 21-year-old man. Mm-hmm. God's design for us is to be mentored and discipled by our own fathers. And I think that extends to career paths, skills, training, things like that. Not necessarily that our dads should have taught us every little skill that we end up using in whatever career we end up in. But our dad should they should have been like the coach, the encourager, the mentor. And a lot of us didn't have that. Like my dad was awesome, but he was not very entrepreneurial. And so I was a little bit on my own when it came to like just developing the skills that I needed to succeed. And I was that super discouraged mid 20 something year old guy, literally, and I didn't have a vision. I think that's a lot of another thing that parents aren't doing a very good job of in the last couple of decades is helping their, like giving a vision for their kids and working with them to like encourage their, you know, their different skills and strengths. And so a lot of times kids are coming out of high school with just literally no idea what in the world they're going to do with their life. And I just want to encourage anyone out listening right now, just like find older, wiser guys in your church, especially those that are in somewhat similar situations that you might want to be in. So for example, if you're interested in business, for example, just any guy in your church. And the other thing is the Lord can use anyone. So just pray that God provides somebody, but, that has the skills that you need, and to reach out to them and see if they're up for getting coffee. That's literally exactly what I did. And God massively blessed that. There was a guy, Chris Taylor, up in Portland. He was a huge, huge blessing to me, him and another guy in our church. I just started meeting with them and they were just kind of mentoring me. And the other thing is like, we're so like at that age, there's still so much, immaturity and foolishness bound up in our hearts. Like you need older guys just to be like, just to tell you no, like, no, that's a bad idea. No, just focus, focus, like just keep doing whatever, like, and,
Hey, Ryan.
Yeah.
Would you share your story of how much money you had in your bank account when you went and met with Chris and started doing your Craigslist hustle? That's such a great story.
Dude, like, I don't know. It's like $75 or something like that. It was pretty.
Wife and what, three or four kids?
It was probably a couple kids at least. Yeah, it could have been three. But yeah, it was a tough situation. And I'd always wanted to go into business and never had any training. I went through public school, so there was no training, like business training or anything like that. And so literally, unless you had a dad or a friend who was a business person, like how in the world were you supposed to learn how to do anything with business? And I remember meeting with them and they're like, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I just want to, I've been interested in business, buying and selling things. And they're like, well, what do you want to buy and sell? And I'm like, I don't know. And Craigslist had just become a thing. And we were living in Portland at the time. And I was like, well, I could buy and sell things on Craigslist and earn money from it. And they're like, okay, well, how are you going to do that? And I'm like, well, I'll find good deals. And they're like, okay, well, how much do you need to make a day just to like the bare minimum just to pay your bills? And I'm like, well, probably $100 a day. And so these two guys, Chris and what's his name?
Is it Paul?
No, it was Orth.
Jason.
Jason. Yeah. Chris and Jason. They're like, okay, all right. Well, you buy and sell things every day and email us at the end of the day and tell us what you bought and sold and how much you made. And it was just like this little bit of accountability. And I had to tell them like, and at the end of the day, if I didn't make enough, they're like, dude, work harder or like work longer. Like, and I just, dude, I was just hustling all day long trying to like, literally I'd like buy a drill and then I'd go sell it. And anyways, that went on. And then all of a sudden I was like, I'd make $100, then 150 and two. And it kept going up and I started like specializing in things. And I eventually got into used appliances. And then it was like $300 and $400 and $500 and $600. Like I started making like really good money. And then I ended up like accidentally stumbling my way into a whole trade, which is learning how to fix appliances and sell them. And, yeah, but it was just like the most simple conversation, and I can still picture it to this day. Like, and it was the most profound thing, but yet it was just so simple. There was, okay, then just do it. Just do that thing, and then we're going to hold you accountable. And so I sent them emails every day for 6 months. And at the end of it, like you could literally do anything. Like you could literally go out, anybody listening right now, you like just buy a weed eater and go out and spend all day trying to get landscaping jobs. And I promise you, after 6 months, you'll be doing very well. Like, it doesn't matter. Just work hard at whatever you do. Be consistent with it. Trust the results of the Lord. And
that accountability piece, though, is huge. I just think, like, yeah, it really is just such a big thing. I mean, because what was happening over that 6 months is you were becoming a different person. Like, you were being disciplined in order to just think about these things. Like my similar story is when I was in college, my cousin was selling, my cousin was my roommate in college, or I think it was my junior year. And he's one of my favorite people in the entire world. He's one of these guys where he just has always had a knack for business, always had a knack for investing. Everything he touches just turns to Bitcoin. He's just one of these guys where he just has a mind for him. And the other thing about him is that he literally brings everything to the Lord in prayer. And so as it relates to investing, this is what he's just always done. He just prays about everything. He's like, what should I, should I get this or not? And something that a lot of people would just be like, oh, God doesn't care about that. He just, in this case, he does. And so he was selling used books. Amazon was, this is 2005 or something. So Amazon was around. And so he just kind of told me what he was doing. And he's like, hey, if you want to do this, like you're more than welcome to do this. I didn't know anything about business. I didn't know anything about, starting my own business, whatever. But we just started going out and buying books together. We had like a little scanner and we had, used our phones. And so we just would, buy and sell these things. And again, most of them were like, all right, you're going to make $4 or $5 on this one, or this one, you're going to make 10, 12. But then you'd find one where you just would find a good deal and you're like, oh my gosh, this textbook, I'm going to sell this and quadruple my money off it. Holy cow. And so I did that, graduated. And then when we first got married, I did that with, within the first like 6 months of being married, I just started doing that on the side and ended up again, making a couple grand a month to where, we had a young family, we were able to live off of it. Again, it wasn't glamorous. There was no sure thing. Like I look back on it now as somebody who's got a job and almost five kids. And I'm just like, what was I thinking? Like what in the world? But like the Lord, the Lord used it. And just, use it to develop the right, right skills to just basically not be afraid of the future, the present, whatever. I think like that's a big part of it is like God is alive. He's in the world and he loves building us up. He loves developing character in us and demonstrating to us that he's a kind father who's every idea that's ever been had that's turned into money has its source in him. And so I think that's another thing, is just like having the confidence to just go to the Lord earnestly in prayer and say, Lord, I know every single good idea exists with you. You could literally give me a $1 trillion idea and I could find a check for $1 million tomorrow. Like there's so many absurd ways in which people have gotten, you know, have gotten to a point, you know, where they have an idea or they have businesses or whatever. There's just so many ways. And so just, you know, not being afraid. I think that's one thing that I would be encouraged, is like, take your fear to the Lord and just entrust it to him, and he will honor that.
Amen. So since we're sharing God's stories, so my quick God story and provision, and it's so funny hearing Ryan talk about how he needed to make $100 a day to pay his bills. Oh, the simpler times. It sounds like
inflation adjusted today, so probably
25 cents and a loaf of bread was a dime, right?
So we aren't as old. We're not really that old, right? Ryan doesn't look old particularly. I look my age. But so when we bought our house in 2013, I was bringing in $2,700 a month. Okay. So we bought this house, and at the time it felt like a lot of money, but I won't even say how much it was. It was very little bit compared to what this house would be now. But I remember that first summer thinking, okay, I don't think I can pay all my bills and my mortgage. Like, they gave me this loan for this house, but money is so tight. And my prayer had been, okay, God, I'm serving as a missionary. I want to be a witness for him. And I just said, God, provide the house, and whoever our neighbors are, I'll reach them and love them for Jesus. And then within a couple months of being at our house, I noticed these two Arabic guys across the street. And I meet them, they invite us over for a meal. And next thing you know, they're saying to me, and they're from the Arab world, they're Muslims, they're here to study English and go to university. And they say to me, we would love to have a Christian family to live with. And I'm like, that's interesting. Well, I know some Christian families with houses. I'll see who I could talk to. Kind of the Samaritan's man walk around the other side of the street.
That's the dumb, dude, it's the Dumb and Dumber scene.
The town.
You go down the road, there's a Christian living down the street.
You might find a cartoon somewhere else.
Who could use some extra income?
And who has extra room in their house, right? Who just bought a house. And anyway, so then I totally miss it. I get home and I talk to my wife. I'm like, these guys, they said the craziest thing. They're like, hey, we want a Christian family to live with. Isn't that weird that these, like, Arab Muslims?
Is this post 9/11, Ash?
Yeah. Actually, okay, that's another funny story. My first night with them, it's like 2 a.m. and we're drinking Cokes and talking. And they ask me in their broken English, I have a question for you. What do you think about Osama bin Laden? So they asked me that. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I should be asking you that question. And they're like, oh, yes, he's very bad. Very bad man. We do not like this guy. He gives Muslim a bad name. So anyway, after my meeting, I go talk to my wife and I said, craziest thing. They want a Christian family to live with. And she goes, oh, we have room.
Yeah.
God bless my godly wife.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, I had to move all my books out of my library in my office, and move into the little furnace room. But so within a month of me saying, I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills, literally the Saudi government is paying me $1,000 a month to host two students in my home and to share God's love with them.
Yeah.
So they basically paid my mortgage for like a few years.
Yeah, that's one of those situations where, again, yeah, you never could have seen it coming, but you know, you just were able to, you know, just respond to the opportunity. And again, there's a risk there. Like, again, like, who are these guys? What do they want? Like, you know, but just the Lord provided an opportunity, and you just walked through.
Yeah, Well, I mean, don't take that advice for every situation.
Correct.
Anyone who listens.
Well, I mean,
be very discerning.
Here's what I said to them. I said, okay, you can move in for a week. If at the end of the week, I still like you and you still like me, you can stay for a month. At the end of the month, I still like you and you still like me, you can stay as long as you want.
See, that's a great plan right there. Yeah.
And they stayed a few years. And then they invited their friends and then the friends and the uncles and the cousins. And yeah. But
well, that's awesome. Well, again, so again, there's three stories we could, we'll probably share more in the future, but yeah, that would be just the encouragement. It would just be, you know, you're not alone. God knows, God understands. God sees the injustice of the situation that you're in. And he, you know, is jealous and able to do things about it. We are coming up in the end of the episode here. We are super grateful for you guys. End of episode 22. We're continuing just plugging along here. If you benefited from this episode, feel free. Go like, subscribe on YouTube. Leave us a review on Apple. I think we're up to like 25 reviews, maybe something. I was like encouraged by how many we had over there, maybe even more, 40 something. But that's by far the best way to continue to spread the word about the podcast. Ryan, Ash, appreciate you guys. And we'll see y'all in the next episode of To the Unknown Pod.